Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Dan Puckett, who teaches at Troy University. Here to talk about his new book, In the Shadow of Hitler, Alabama's Jews, the Second World War, and the Holocaust, published in 2014 by the University of Alabama Press. Dan, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. So, Dan, you originally set out to write a different book, but you ended up writing this one. Can you tell us briefly about how that came about?
Sure. The book I had intended to write is the one I'm actually working on right now. It was looking at African Americans' response to Nazism, to the rise of Hitler, to the events going on, to World War II, and the revelations of the Holocaust. And I was looking at how that affected civil rights, their demands for civil rights. And I started this project when I was in graduate school at Mississippi State. And my advisor, when I was working on this, he asked me, well, what are the Jews doing? Well, I don't know. And so I thought, well, I'll spend 2 weeks and get the Jewish perspective. And here it is, years and years later, and I'm working in this field now because it's so fascinating. It was supposed to be 2 chapters, in a book. And I took a trip to New York. I was actually going up to the Schomburg Center for Black Culture and History. I was planning on spending a week and a half in Harlem up at the Schomburg. And there was a couple of collections I wanted to look at the Center for Jewish History. And so I allocated maybe a day and a half. And, I went there first just to get it out of the way. And I ended up spending the entire except for a day that I spent at the Schomburg, I spent the entire time at the Center for Jewish History. And I found more information on Alabama's Jews in New York than I found, in all of Alabama combined. It was a treasure trove. So I came home with probably 2 banker's boxes full of material. And the more I dug and the more I pulled at these little threads, the more information, the more questions came out. And it was pretty apparent that this warranted its own book instead of just a couple of chapters. And so that's how it turned into this book. And this is really my overriding interest now is Jewish history.
Mm-hmm. It's a very nice plug for the Center for Jewish History, and also grad students out there, be open to how things come at you. You never know.
You really don't know, because I never would have thought that I would be in doing what I'm doing in this field now. And it's a fascinating field to get into.
So, Dan, what drew you to Alabama? You say that in many ways the response of Alabama's Jews to Hitler, sort of mirrored American Jews' response throughout the United States. So tell us a little bit about the similarity there, but in what ways was Alabama unique and worth telling separately?
Well, the reason I got involved in Alabama is I'm an Alabamian. I grew up in Birmingham, and Alabama is, if you look at the southern states, at least during the 1920s, the 1930s, and 40s, I thought it was a little bit different. It has different aspects to it. It's got really the industrial heart of the South in Birmingham, really a new South city. A couple of hours down the highway, you have really the old capital of the Confederacy. The center of the Black Belt, the plantation region. In Mobile, just south of that, really has a Caribbean feel. So there are really different regions within the state that are very different from one another. So that's how I got involved with Alabama, is because I'm from the state, and the state's always fascinated me. You're asking about how Alabama's Jews mirrored. One of the things that we often hear is that American Jews didn't do enough during the Holocaust to save, to rescue, to aid. the persecuted Jews. And when I got into this, what I found is that that's not true at all, especially if you look beyond the national organizations and taking a look at a local community. And there's a number of different communities in Alabama, but they came together and they did everything in their power to aid, to rescue these persecuted German Jews. And in a lot of ways, what their experience in Alabama, and it's not just their response to Hitler and the Holocaust, but it's, I think it's their entire experience in the South mirrors a lot of the experience of Jews in smaller towns, smaller communities, whether it's in the Midwest or the West. You know, oftentimes we like to look at New York, New York City, the Northeast, really where the bulk of American Jewry resides. But I think comparing small communities, such as in Alabama or Georgia or Mississippi or perhaps in the Midwest or West to New York, that's not really a good comparison. So if you compare Jews in Alabama, let's say Birmingham, to a comparable city at the time, like Indianapolis, for instance, I think you'll see a lot of the same elements, the same things happening there. And so what I'm finding in Alabama is what I would like to see more of, an examination of these smaller communities, these smaller towns. How are they responding? So if, you know, and just looking at the national scope of things, the national organizations, what's going on in New York really doesn't tell the entire story. And I think it's a much different view from, you know, from these smaller communities.
Part of the story, you know, maybe it's sort of a backstory, is that there are certain rifts in the Alabama Jewish community. Can you tell us, you know, sort of what are some of those fault lines?
Well, that was a theme really that ran throughout the book. Is you know, there were really in Alabama three distinct Jewish communities. You have, of course, the German Jews that came in the early and mid 19th century. They were of the Reformed tradition. Then in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you had Eastern European Jews that that immigrated. And in Montgomery in the early 20th century, you had a Sephardic group that migrated here. And they were, you talk about rifts, there were tremendous differences, cultural differences, religious differences, certainly economic differences. The older German Jews had been much more established, much more successful in business and politics and society. And, you know, I think they were embarrassed in some ways by these newcomers, the Eastern European Jews that didn't assimilate the way that the Reformed Jews had, that, you know, clung to the Jewish traditions and attempted to keep kosher, which was virtually impossible in small towns at that point. And so that was the rift that took place. Now, by the time you get to the 1930s, you're two or three generations in, but there's still profound differences, cultural differences here that, you know, if you talk to some of the members of the Jewish community, especially the older members of these Jewish communities, they'll admit they're still there, even though after World War II, there was a lot of intermarriage that took place between the sub communities, but as they'll be happy to tell you that, you know, those rifts are still there.
Right, and the rifts, you know, make it all the more remarkable that they put aside their differences to work together during the 1930s and 1940s. Is that right?
That's correct. They did. In fact, now they fought a great deal. They battled with each other a great deal, especially over the issue of Zionism. But when it came to aiding and attempting to rescue the persecuted Jews from the Nazis, then they put aside their differences and worked together. And I think that was that spoke volumes about what they cared about and how they saw themselves and their role.
Mm-hmm. You know, then, just like now, Jews were a minority. So in order to, operate at, sort of levels of power, they needed to get help from the wider community, from non-Jews. How did they go about thinking about how to do that?
You know, this is something that, if you look at Alabama's Jews during the 1930s and 40s, they were less than 1% of the population. Yet they wielded enormous influence, much larger than their numbers would suggest. They were integrated into the economic fabric of the communities, not just as merchants, but in banking and finance and real estate. They belonged to almost all of the civic organizations. In fact, they're in Montgomery, in Mobile, for instance, you had Jews that were elected mayor, elected in high public office. Now, that being said, they also could not join the country club. And so there were social exclusions, but they were very influential civically and economically in these communities. And generally, the leaders came from the Reform community. That's not to say that Eastern European Jews weren't influential, but they didn't wield that influence that Reform Jews had. So, and one of the things that I think is interesting is that there was enormous support for Jewish endeavors on the part of the Gentile community. And of course, that there's reasons for that, but just to give you some examples, in 1933, when Hitler came to power in April, when the anti-Semitic persecutions began, you start to see politicians, Gentile politicians, prompted by their Jewish constituents, begin to pass resolutions. Now, this has no effect on what's going on in Germany, but at least they're making their voices known in protest. And you see this throughout the 1930s and the 1940s.
Right. And that sort of, adds to what you said before, that there was a level of awareness about what was going on that I don't think we realize.
No. In fact, they knew exactly what was going on. In fact, the Jewish community, more so than anyone else, was keenly tuned in to the events in Europe. So many had family there and were interested in what was happening to the Jews there. But also the newspapers, and this is something that I think is missed in some cases. The newspapers covered this. In the research I did in my graduate studies and later, I looked at every newspaper in Alabama from the 1930s to the end of World War II. And certainly the daily newspapers covered the events in Europe in depth. Now, it may not have been on the front page, but the editorial pages, the voice of the newspaper gave it a prominence that I think we overlook. So people knew what was going on. Now, whether or not when you talk about the exterminations, in 42, 43, 44, whether or not they appreciated or perhaps grasped the enormity of that's another question. But they knew what was happening.
I want to come back to the media in a minute, but first I just want to ask, you talk in the introduction about a cognitive dissonance that some of the Southern Jews felt. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was? And, do you think that your original research about African Americans and race sort of helped you pick up on some of that?
Yes, it absolutely did. One of the things that I was looking at originally was, and it wasn't focused on the Jews. It was focused on the larger white community in Alabama and how they responded initially to Nazism and Nazi racism, its claims of Aryan supremacy, its discrimination against Jews and other minorities. Interestingly, you know, the white Southerners, at least from what I've looked at, I know in Alabama, and I've looked in some of the other newspapers in states, that white Southerners condemned Nazism, condemned Hitler, condemned the treatment of these minorities from the very beginning. Now, they were more critical of Nazi aggression, its anti-democratic tendencies, its brutality, rather than specifically its racism, but that was part of it. So they're condemning the Nazis, they're condemning Hitler for the treatment of their minorities, yet when you look at Jim Crow society in the 1930s, there's not a lot of difference between what was going on in Germany and what was going on in the American South. And if you look at the Nazi racial thought and you look at Southern racial thought, it is eerily similar here. And so when I talk about cognitive dissonance, white Southerners don't see that. They don't see the similarities. They condemn Hitler. They condemn the Nazis. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, that's not us. That's extremist groups like the Ku Klux Klan, not looking at the type of society they've created. And the point I made in the book is that that extended to Jews as well. Now, there may be a number of reasons why Southern Jews embraced white supremacy. I'm not sure you can say any were virulent segregationist or racist, but they certainly didn't speak out. And I think most of them weren't in the position to speak out or didn't feel comfortable speaking out, given the fact that, well, that would put a target on their back. But looking at some of the private papers, some of the letters, some of the correspondence, they're not talking about this privately either. I mean, it's understandable they're not talking about it publicly, but they're not talking about it privately either. So that's when I say the cognitive dissonance, they don't recognize these similarities. And I don't think Southern Jews really recognized or at least admitted these similarities.
I want to talk about chapter two, which deals with the refugee crisis.
Yes.
So after you know, in chapter one, you go through how Jews initially responded to Nazi persecution and, you know, sort of the early years of the rise of Hitler. Tell us very briefly about the NCC and the NRS.
Well, the NCC, the National Coordinating Committee for the Refugees from Germany, was created. This was it came from New York, and all the national Jewish organizations were based in New York. But it was attempting to aid those refugees that were able to get out of Germany. The NRS, the National Refugee Service, emerged out of the NCC. So they're really the same organization. But the NRS was focused specifically on refugees. And so they're the ones that attempted to resettle refugees throughout the United States. Those that came into the U.S. generally came into New York. And so, you know, Jewish groups in New York were worried about, this influx of large numbers of refugees because they really didn't want to leave. And they were worried about a number of issues. First of all, overtaxing the Jewish support services in New York, creating Jewish ghettos, the rise of anti-Semitism. And so they thought the best way to handle this influx is to settle Jews throughout the country into smaller communities. And so the NRS sent representatives to various communities throughout, I think it was over 900 different communities throughout the United States, trying to organize support for resettlement. you know, getting these communities to agree to accept refugees, to resettle. And in Alabama, in Birmingham, in Mobile, Montgomery, Selma, places in the north and the west, they were willing to do that. And it's a number of, this is really where you see this rift being put aside to aid, not just to donate and to work for the relief of those in Europe, but also to help support those who arrive.
We touched on it earlier, but you know, as close as the different communities came together and worked together, Zionism seemed to be an issue where the rifts remained. Why was that?
Oh, that was the cause of the largest rift, is the issue of Zionism, the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. You know, it's one of the interesting things, if you look at the Jewish community today, one of the key things is support for Israel. And even in the Reformed congregations, there is a lot of Hebrew in the services, emphasis on Israel, on the Jewish state. And when I began the research, I was amazed to find that there was tremendous animosity towards Zionism from the Reformed community. You know, they viewed assimilation as the key to success. And they were frankly afraid that if they voiced support for another state, they would be accused of dual loyalty. You know, who are they loyal to, the United States or to this Jewish state? Now, where Eastern European Jews were generally the backbone of the Zionist movements throughout Alabama. Birmingham, Montgomery, Mobile, that's generally the largest populations, and that's where the Zionist organizations reside. But this caused, I think, the greatest discord between these communities is over the Jewish state. You know, I interviewed a number of older members of the community when I was doing this. There was one gentleman. He was, I think he was 95 when I interviewed him. And so he was well aware of what was going on in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And, but very much a supporter, very much a member of that traditional reform movement that, you know, he wanted nothing to do at all with Israel. And that was, I would say common, but it was, you know, it was often that I would run into that. But you know, that's one of the things that I think drove the wedge or kept that chasm between these two groups for so long.
Mm-hmm. In chapter four, you look at the Alabama press. We touched a little bit on this earlier, but can you tell us briefly, what was the mainstream Alabama press's approach and what was the black press's approach to Nazism? Because it seems like they were slightly different, the way they were treated.
Oh, very much so. If you look at the white press, for instance, they condemn Nazism, but in dealing with the racial issues, this is really where the differences came in, is that now there was no white journalist, no white editor, no white newspaper that called for an end to segregation, that called for an end to Jim Crow. You know, but they would, in essence, the white press, basically like the white population, would blame the racial violence in the South on those extremist elements. One of the cartoons I've included in my book was basically a hooded Klansman with a swastika on his chest. And that's how they portrayed it, is that, you know, the lynchings, the beatings, the, you know, really the violence was not part of good white Southern society. That's, That's the extremist. On the other hand, African Americans pointed out this hypocrisy. And they were saying, no, this is, it's endemic to Jim Crow. You can't just point to the Klan when, you know, you're condemning the Jews, the Nazis for treating the Jews as second class citizens. And they'll point out the same way that they're treated as second class citizens in the South. So, tremendous differences. Now, the one thing that, that the black press does when they're talking about racism and discrimination and violence, they use the term Hitlerism, or Nazism to describe this, this Southern racial violence. So, you know, they recognize, you know, the similarities here. And so they'll use those terms. You know, one of the things when they, and they also use terms that resonate with their readers. When they were describing the extermination camps after the liberation of Auschwitz and the news filtered back, they began to use terms, like, you know, the Jewish victims being lynched or segregated concentration camps. So things that their readers would certainly understand.
I want to ask you about two important figures in the book, because, you know, these aren't probably not household names, but there are two clergymen, or one clergyman and one former clergyman, mm-hmm. maybe. One is Rabbi Milton Grafman, who's a very fascinating character, and the other is the Catholic priest, Arthur Terminiello. Tell us briefly about those.
Well, Milton Grafman, he basically, he served Temple Emmanuel in Birmingham from 1941. He got there the day after Pearl Harbor. He was installed as rabbi. He officially retired in 1975, but he lived another 20 years and was extremely active in the Birmingham community. So, you know, from the end of 1941, really to 1995, when he passed away, he was a dominant figure for many Jews in Birmingham, and certainly for the Gentile population, you know, because they looked to the Reform rabbis really as the spokesman for the Jewish community. So he really was a giant in Birmingham and Alabama in regard to Judaism. You know, what's interesting, I wrote a little piece in about Grafman. He was installed in 1941. He had followed a long-serving rabbi, Rabbi Newfield, who had been in Birmingham from, I think, 1895 until he died in 1940. Newfield was very much of the Reformed tradition. He was not a supporter of Zionism. He was not an anti-Zionist, but he wasn't a supporter of Zionism. He was, in essence, a very moderate figure, but a very revered figure, being there as long as he was, some 45 years. And by the end of 41, here comes this young firebrand, Milton Grafman, who is outspoken and who is an ardent Zionist. And so there was a lot of controversy in Temple Emmanuel over his support for Zionism. He was very outspoken. He was not afraid to say what was on his mind. In fact, he often spoke his mind from the pulpit. That caused a lot of, uneasiness and maybe discomfort among his congregants. In fact, there led to a falling out. I wrote about this in the book, a falling out with some of his congregants over the issue of Zionism. So he was very outspoken, did a lot to spearhead this Zionist movement. Now, he was not there early on. I mean, the backbone of the Zionist movement, Birmingham, was the Eastern European Jews. But Grafman, with his position as a Reform rabbi, was well positioned to take Zionism to the larger Gentile community, or at least those aspects that it could support. On the other hand, Father Arthur Terminello, now that is a character. He was in the mold of Father Coughlin. In fact, he was often called the Father Coughlin of the South. Now, Father Coughlin, as many of you know, was an anti-Semitic priest. They called the radio priest, who blasted out anti-Semitic speeches. He was not a fan of the New Deal, not a fan of Theodore Roosevelt. And Arthur Terminello was, in essence, our version of Father Coughlin here in Alabama. He had a number of newspapers that he ran. Father Coughlin had a newspaper called Social Justice. Well, Arthur Terminello here in Alabama had a newspaper called Rural Justice. After that was stopped, he moved around from parish to parish to parish because he kept getting into trouble with basically his superiors. Until in 1944, he had gone too far. He had a radio program like Father Coughlin. And after, in essence, slamming Roosevelt and basically saying that Roosevelt had tricked us into war, had lied us into war, he was defrocked, by the bishop in Mobile, Tulip. And, then he began a speaking tour with Gerald L. K. Smith, the leading anti-Semite in the U.S. At the time, and he began going on speaking tours all over the country, speaking with Smith and a number of other anti-Semites. So he was really a very virulent anti-Semite here in Alabama.
Yeah, there are a number of colorful characters in the book. Dan, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thank
the book
you for
is
having
in,
me.
The book is In the Shadow of Hitler, Alabama's Jews, the Second World War, and the Holocaust, published in 2014 by the University of Alabama Press. The author is Dan Puckett. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.